From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. What can I say about my guest? Well, he's worked with directors from Martin Scorsese to Walter Hill, Oliver Stone to Wes Anderson, Paul Schrader to Sam Raimi, and like the latter two, I think of him as a Midwestern guy with a strong work ethic. He's also a Midwesterner like me who has the taste for Prada. My guest is, of course, Willem Dafoe. His new film is Inside. Willem, thank you so much for doing this.
My pleasure.
And I do think of you as a Midwestern guy with a strong work ethic.
Yeah, I think both are true. I definitely have a strong work ethic, and I'm definitely a Midwestern guy. So, you know, yeah, check, check.
In seeing Inside, I thought of a story I read that in an interview you gave. You talked about as a kid imitating the one of the Gemini astronauts and locking yourself in a closet for a day or so.
It's true. It's true. No, but I didn't tell that story just to tell a weird childhood story. It was in the context of talking about claustrophobia. And I guess my point was that always I had been a little fascinated by the combination of isolation and will and where your mind goes when you're alone. I guess I'm bragging because that, in retrospect, that seemed kind of special for a kid that was, you know, 6, 7 years old.
Tell the audience a little bit what the film's about, because it's a very interesting story.
The premise is really simple and lends itself to a really strong narrative that, you know, serves kind of a thriller, a suspense appetite. But there's an art thief. He breaks into a luxury penthouse in a New York high rise. And it's a huge place. It's filled with priceless art. It's got a smart, you know, alarm system, smart everything. He goes in there. He's going to take 3 Egon Schieles and leave. When he hacks out of the system goes awry and locks him in and clearly doesn't notify anybody. There's been a breach of the security system. Everything goes out of whack. The heating system goes out of whack. The alarm system goes out of whack. He's locked in there. Initially, he's wondering who's going to come. Nobody comes. He's stuck there. Clearly, nobody's been there for a while. He's surrounded by this art. He's got to figure out what to eat. There's very little food available. The water is turned off. Clearly, the owner's been away for a while, and he's got to figure out how to survive. So it starts out as kind of this Robinson Crusoe survival story, but then it morphs into something else.
It does. Like I said, I thought about claustrophobia because as Nemo, your character's in the room longer and longer, his space gets smaller and smaller. The room seems to shrink around him.
You know, in the beginning, I think Vasilis wanted to shoot me quite small, to keep me quite small in the space. It's quite a large penthouse. It's all open, 2 levels. And then as the film progresses, we come closer and closer and closer to Nemo. We become more with him. And the space, by comparison, gets bigger and bigger.
I mean, talk to me about how you prepare for something like this besides locking yourself in a closet as a 6-year-old.
You don't. No, you don't prepare because there's no backstory to play. I don't believe in that anyway. You play scenes. And the story begins with this dilemma of being trapped in there. And fortunately, practically, we shot in chronological order. So what we were doing, we were in the space. We didn't have to anticipate scenes down the road or scenes that already happened. I'm basically... There are a couple other actors in a special sequence, but it's basically just me and the space. So we had a very practical approach. The script was very clear, and the points of the obstacles and certain actions are very clear and charted out. But the time between those events wasn't charted at all. Those were things we had to flesh out. So what was interesting is, I mean, I would go to work every day, like for a 12-hour day, just me and the crew. But we basically inhabit at that place. Like when I finally do find some food, rather than setting up a shot and then figuring out what we were going to do, they would let me figure out how to open the cans. You know, we did a very practical approach. We kind of found the film as we did it. And we shot a lot of things that probably wouldn't end up in the film. And we invented a lot of things that weren't in the script that ended up in the film. So it was very loose, but at the same time, you know, we weren't stopping to talk ideas. We always had a very clear course of action. And that was, how does he get out? And how's he doing? And how's he getting the things that he needs?
It's funny because you talked about him getting food. I mean, that to me is almost like a real suspense sequence. That the opening of the can is almost like watching somebody crack a safe in a heist movie. There's a lot of tension in that scene, isn't there?
Right. And the beauty is, you know, we do eventually figure out how to frame it and all that sort of thing. But the way we find it is sort of practical. It's almost like a living installation piece. You know, I'm figuring this stuff out, and then we decide certain things to lift out by filming it.
It's almost as if Nemo's on display in an installation, because at one point he goes to look for the Chile in the video installation room, and it's not there. It's like that in some ways seems to sort of like prefigure what the rest of the movie's going to be.
Right, right. And there's some question about maybe someone's watching. I mean, that's not the case, but this film has this really strong baseline of he's got to get out, he's got to solve these problems, he's forced to go more and more inside himself. But on the other hand, in dealing with the art, it starts to raise certain questions about what art means to us, what we need. It raises questions about the dark side of luxury. Lots of things start to come up, and not in a didactic or pointed or delivered way. They're just in the room, and they kind of occur to the audience as they're watching it. In fact, this is kind of a movie that I think the audience makes with the character as they watch it. And that's kind of amazing. So on one level, you have the security of a narrative for people that really cling to those things. And there's kind of a game to figure out how he's going to get out. And on the other hand, the juxtaposition and the weirdness of the situation really brings up kind of very interesting elemental questions.
It really does. We're talking about problem solving. I guess Willem Dafoe, his new film, is a film inside. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com/The Treatment. One of the reasons I said I think of you as a hardworking Midwestern kid, and something we've talked about before, but also because so much of the work you've done has been with these characters who are kind of goal-oriented, and Nemo is one of those people. And at a certain point, the goals go from being so big as just trying to get out to being so small as trying to survive from moment to moment.
Well, I'd say that's pretty much the case through the whole movie, moment to moment, and that's the beauty of it. We have a clear direction that's pushing us forward, but also we have the luxury, since we're shooting in chronological order and we're shooting in a very loose-footed way because there's only one actor and a crew behind that actor, we could invent a lot of stuff and go places that I wouldn't say were totally improvisational, but we really found the film as we shot it. And I think that's so important because one of the problems when you make a film is, yes, you have to prepare by the nature of how you make film, and you have to all be on the same page. You got to design things. You got to have everything up your sleeve. And then you go to the location and you execute. Well, sometimes you get there and things aren't quite as you imagined and you don't make the change. Well, here, this was a case of, we had a good plan. Then we got there. We really dealt with what was in the room because the story was built that way. And our crew and our way of approaching the movie was built that way. Believe it or not, we never even talked about how long he was there, because that wasn't important. We didn't want to get into wigs and beards and selling the passage of time. So we just accepted that from day one, I'd stop cutting my hair, I'd stop shaving, I'd let my nails grow. I would bathe out of courtesy to the crew. But other than that, I'd kind of let myself go and have the rigor of working 12 hours a day, you know, 6 days a week on a pretty intense physical movie work on me. So that is an organic process that I'm tapping into, because that's not an idea. That's not even planned. We're tapping into what's there, and it's telling us what to do. It's a beautiful way to work.
Maybe one of my favorite scenes in the movie is when he's telling that joke about the kid asking what's for dinner. That really is kind of the metaphor for the entire movie about repetition.
That's like the kind of thing of sometimes we'd literally be sitting around and we'd be designing shots and we'd be doing passage of time. And I'd start to do these things and we'd say, hey, let's go with that. And that was a case of, I like that joke very much. And as you can kind of faintly hear in the voiceover, I do explain that it's a joke I learned when I was working in a movie in Bulgaria. And this woman was a gifted joke teller, and she told me this joke. I'm not a very good joke teller, but that didn't stop me from doing it in the movie. And I tell this joke. How it was going to be used, how it fits in the story, we didn't really know. But it had a texture, and we liked the joke, and I enjoyed doing it. So we shoot it, and then we see what happens. But a lot of things like that happened. The drawing on the wall, we prepared for one thing, and then decided that wasn't right, so we invented it on the spot. That's exciting. It gives you energy. It gives you a relationship to your surroundings, to what you're doing, to all the objects in the room. You own that place. There's nothing false. There's nothing that doesn't have a story. There's nothing that isn't connected. And for an actor, that is fantastic because the situation tells you what to do. There's no thinking. There's no pointing. There's no dealing with what's outside the space. Things do occur to you, but what you're really concentrated on is the doing. And the doing, I trust. And when it's physical, I trust it even more because the body has a certain kind of wisdom and a kind of truth. And you're not telegraphing anything. You're not indicating anything. You're doing things. And there's a lot of that in this movie. And if that sounds boring, I don't think it is because it's framed interestingly. And also the context that is being done really elevates these very simple tasks into things that you almost see as incredible actions, even though they're very mundane actions.
We should take a break here. There's a lot to talk about. My guest is Willem Dafoe, who I've known for a while, finally got him to do this show, and this is the perfect movie to talk about for him. The film is Inside. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com. There's more to come. Stay with us. He's still here. I won't let him leave. Willem Dafoe's talking
I'm
to
here.
Us. It's The Treatment.
I didn't go
Thank
anywhere.
You. We're talking about, of course, this terrific new film, Inside. You can also see the show at kcrw.com/The Treatment. But you were talking about passage of time. And I thought what happens at a certain point, too, is that we go so far, if you pardon me for saying this, inside Nemo that we're not sure how reliable what he's seeing is by the end of the movie.
It's true. And usually that's pretty tough in a movie. You get a little annoyed if someone isn't clear about their different realities. At least most people get frustrated by that. But this is really fluid. When you talk about time, I must share, let's say, another really wonderful thing about shooting this was it's a single location. Maybe it's obvious from the story, but it's a single location. And it's a set because without giving you too many spoilers, the penthouse becomes very beat up and degraded in the course of the movie. So that's one of the reasons we had to shoot in chronological order. But it was a set that was built on a soundstage. And you go in there every day for 12 hours, it's dark. There are huge windows, but there are projections outside. So the light isn't a real daylight or real nighttime. And the sense of time gets totally bent. That is very interesting. I mean, I always like to stay on the set when I'm shooting a movie, but never before, I think, have I literally walked into the set at the beginning of the day and never left that until the very moment that we wrapped at night. So we were really living in that place. We were really inhabiting it.
It's almost too, it's like we're kind of watching the progression from childhood to death in the movie in some ways. The very beginning, he's goofing around, he's surfing down the stairs, and there's this almost this kind of exuberance. Well, I'm bored. I'm going to make what I can of this because I'll get out of this eventually. I don't want to get too much into the theoretical stuff because I know that's not the way you get down, but it felt to me like in some ways that we're kind of watching sort of the evolution of a person from beginning to end. You know, like I say, he's like a kid once he realizes what the situation was. And the situation gets more dire and the stakes are raised. He's kind of growing up in some ways.
I think that's fair. I don't disagree with you. I would express it in a slightly different way. We don't know this, but for my money in the beginning, there's no evidence that he's a particularly introspective guy. He's an art freak. He has some kind of feeling for art, but he mostly likes the fact that he's going to steal it and he's going to make some money. But once he gets there, the situation forces him to deal with himself. You know, you can't help but think, you know, of the Pascal quote, you know, the French philosopher about all the ills of humanity could be solved. You know, wouldn't happen if a man couldn't stay alone in his room. People don't know how to be by themselves. He is forced in this situation to go inside. And I think he comes to some kind of understanding. And when you see him toward the end, his way of surviving is through an understanding, some sort of better understanding of himself. And it's really facilitated through his interaction with the art and a certain kind of hope that he creates by making these things that practically may help him get out, but also give him courage and hope, you know, in his heart.
Yeah, I think part of it, too, is that you're talking about the pristine quality of the set. I thought of it as being in some ways, too, because there's so much you can ascribe to this movie, man. Beginning, it's a temple, and by the end, he's desecrated this temple.
Or it was desecrated before, and he turns it into a temple. Depends how you look at it.
I mean, too, because again,
it depends how you like your art.
I mean, it's so much this thing is about kind of the eye of the beholder for me.
You know, one thing that always strikes me is all over the movie. And, you know, like I say, these are things that interest me. People are going to bring what they will to the movie. But for me, one of the things that happens over and over and over in the movie, I saw it the other day, and I can really watch it with a certain kind of objectivity. I can't usually, but I couldn't somehow. At the beginning, you see this art. And in the beginning, it represents power, luxury, possibility of freedom. If you're, you know, a materialist, it has one thing coming off of it. Or if you love art, it may be something beautiful to you. Purely aesthetically, it may give you pleasure. Well, by the end, it becomes something completely different. And in the middle, once he finds out he's trapped, this thing that would be so valuable to him becomes useless. Because what does he need? He needs food. He needs water. And then later, it becomes valuable to him again. So every object, we project a nature or a value onto it. But the value in the nature isn't inherent in the object. It's really about how we approach it, what the context is. And once you start thinking about that thing, that things don't have an absolute nature, it opens up a whole thing into how you see the world, how you walk through the world, and how everything is alive depending on the situation.
The more I watched it, I watched it a couple of times to get ready for this, I thought this was kind of the perfect thing for you to do. Because again, it reminded me of seeing you on stage, and there was an excitement uh-huh. You would get when you would pick something up on stage. I mean, it was almost like you were grabbing something for the first time. I think that tension and seeing the possibilities in something would be transferred to the audience. And so to be able to physicalize this character in this thriller context was really exciting to me to see this. Again, it felt like the perfect film for you. And I don't know why I thought that.
You know, I had a friend come up to me at the screening the other day, and he was someone that I worked with at the theater. And he said, "You always loved doing physical things and you always loved props. And there you are."
It's the treatment. My guest is actor and prop master Willem Dafoe. His new film as an actor is Inside. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com. But I just found myself thinking, I brought up the temple thing because it also, to me, feels like kind of a parable that begins and ends with an anecdote. And I want to ask you about the way you voice that anecdote for the beginning and the end, because it's very different. And I think in really nuanced ways, but the voicing of that story that Nemo tells at the beginning and end of the movie tells us a lot about where he is as much as anything else.
There's very little dialogue, but I say something to the effect in a voiceover in the beginning that says something to the effect of,
what are the three things I would save from my house if it were on fire?
Yeah.
We talked about the things he would save. He says, and this is really key to me, I didn't mention my parents or my sister. Does that make me a bad person? That to me was the key to the film. And when he pieced that anecdote, and it's really about the transitory quality of art.
It means something completely different. Because in the beginning, when you hear him say, art is for keeps, you get a very concrete picture. By the end, when he says art for keeps, even though it's said in a slangy kind of kid language, you feel like he understands that art is eternal. It's something that we leave behind, and it's an expression of what went before. So that kind of bookends the two things. I don't lean on that too heavy because I don't want to tie it up with a bow. But certainly, there's another example of the same thing seen from different points of view are very different. And whenever we can start thinking like that, I think it opens up our thinking in a way that makes us much more creative, much more tolerant, and much more fluid and able to deal with this crazy world.
It's so funny because, you know, just watching stuff to get ready for this, and it's been a real pleasure just to watch a bunch of Willem Dafoe films. I was really, and we also had Walter Hill on last fall for Dead for a Dollar. And I was thinking about juxtaposing these characters because Cribbins is somebody who's really incredibly physically confident and doesn't say a lot either, actually. And so the difference between Nemo, who sort of knows very specifically what to do. I mean, I could imagine Cribbins sitting in that place and not saying anything for hours at a time. Whereas watching...
Oh, I think he'd sing some songs.
But you know what I mean? He has enough confidence to know how to amuse himself.
You know, he's an adult and he's been around the block. Joe Cribbins in that movie Dead for the Dollar, he's wrapping it up. He wants to find peace. He's a guy that's maybe done some bad things, but he's wrapping it up. He wants to chill now. So he's come to some sort of place of wisdom where Nemo, that character, starts out at the beginning of Inside. He's nowhere near that.
Both these characters are about physicality. I mean, I just think about how sure Cribbins is with his hands. He knows where his hands are at all times, partially because they're his instruments, but also because he's so confident about what he can do with them.
I agree. I like physical characters. Then I know what to do. If a character's not physical, I'm a little at a loss, and I gotta really find my way in.
Well, I was going to ask you, too, because I was wondering what it was like to get a chance to work with Walter again, Walter Hill.
Beautiful. I worked with him like 40 years ago.
Yeah. Streets of Fire.
Streets of Fire. And he was good, you know. He was so good. It was like we didn't stop, you know. That's a 40 years hiccup, you know. It was like we were back on the sets of Streets of Fire. He hadn't changed much. I suppose I changed a lot because I was just a kid when I worked with him before. But I enjoyed it so much, and I think, you know, it was a low budget film. We were really challenged with our resources, but it kind of matched. It was like a very late Western and not a typical Western. So I think because of the simplicity of how we approached it, one of the problems with Westerns now is they spin them, you know? And this one was a real meat and potatoes. It was true to the Westerns that he grew up with, that he loved. And it was nice to be part of that labor love.
Again, watching these characters who are so confident as compared to watching Nemo, who at the age he is should be a lot more confident about himself than he is. I'm just fascinated by all that.
And, you know, like working with Walter, he understands film language so well that, you know, he's not a guy that gets involved with ideas too much. You know, he used this film language to express things directly. It's not like he has an idea and then he uses the language to convey his idea. It's like he goes straight to the source, uses the film language to get you there.
The last question I want to ask you, too, what's your first meeting with the director was like when you guys were talking about the material?
It was lots of meetings because he had this idea a long time ago, like maybe 10 years ago, the basic idea. And he worked with a screenwriter, and the screenwriter, Ben Hopkins, wrote a script, and we did use the script. It just was a bit of a blueprint for us. We had to fill in lots of parts of it. But the initial meeting, you know, it was a very long process because he had to do a big research to design the house. And part of me believing he was up to the task because he had never done a feature before was I liked how he shared the materials with me about the collection, the art collection, which had to be legit or the movie won't work, and about the space, which had to be really correct or the film won't work. So dealing with him on that stuff, that was a whole conversation that lasted, that went over a couple of years on and off. And also it was a period where I was very busy and I wasn't available, and they were really good. They waited for me basically. And then once we found a moment, we shot it, and that was that. Yeah, one of the only interesting things about, I guess I'm trying to tell you in a very long-winded way, which I sometimes do, is it was a long process. It wasn't like a slam dunk, do this, here's the deal, let's go. It was a long process, but it was part of his development process. So including me in that was very important. One of the interesting things is he said before the first meeting, his producer, Yorgos Karnavas, a really great, great producer, said, and some of his other colleagues said, listen, before we have the meeting with Willem, we really got to pitch him the backstory of this guy. And Vasilis said, no, I'm not interested in backstory. I'm not interested in backstory. They said, no, every actor wants a backstory. They want to know who this character is. And Vasilis said, no, I'm not going to do a backstory. And they had a little tiff, and they talked. And finally, they said, okay, let's have the meeting. And I walked in. And one of the first things out of my mouth is, I don't know who this guy is, and I don't think you can play backstory. I'm not interested in a backstory. So Vasilis' eyes lit up, and, you know, it was love. What can I tell you?
We're talking about Vasilis Katsoupis, the director. And again, that's why I went back to watch the Walter Hill stuff, too, especially because Walter's the same way. What you're seeing on the screen there is who the character is. That's all we need to know about him.
No, I think that's really important because sometimes movies try to accomplish things that aren't in the movie. They're pointing to stuff outside, or they're pointing to stuff that isn't accomplished with what we're seeing. You know, they're indicating, and it breaks the flow of things. It becomes egoistic. It becomes an idea. It becomes something that isn't cinematic. And I really respond when, you know, there's something that you can feel, something... when I say feel, I mean you can touch, you know, something you can concretely do.
My guest is Willem Dafoe, whose new film as an actor is Inside. Thanks again. It's always great talking to you.
All right. Thanks, Elvis.
Actor Willem Dafoe, who's gone from big-budget Marvel movies to marvelous small ones. He's currently starring in the indie thriller Inside, which is now in theaters. There is appeal, I hope, to be found on previous episodes, which are at kcow.com/thetreatment. There's more to come. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. And if you've been cruising the internet looking for vigorous, thoughtful perspective on film, its history, its past, present, and future, you have, of course, come up on the blog Self-Style Siren. My guest is its author and mainstay and founder, who's been doing it since 2005, Fran Neme. First of all, you had a couple of great pieces recently about both Burt Bacharach and the movie Babylon, All the Bees. But I mean, I think those pieces are as reflective of the way you work and the way you think about movies and your perspective as anything else.
Well, thank you. Both of them were quite pleasant to write, even though I really didn't care for Babylon, but the assignment from Vanity Fair was to write about its roots in real old Hollywood. And I was like, yes, this is an assignment I can take. And it was a pleasure to go through that movie. There's a huge jumble of references, but I kind of tried to pick out certain strands where I could say, okay, here is the person, and here is a movie that you might like, because I see myself as an evangelist as much as anything. You know, please go out and look at this old movie. You may find you really, really like it. And with Burt Bacharach, yeah, that was a chance to kind of weave my appreciation of his music into looking at the way that the songs and things that he wrote really enhanced the movies that he participated in.
Well, one of the things I've always found in your writing that I think is fascinating and really quite powerful about the work is the way you're able to sort of ask us to sort of separate our emotional responses to what's factual. And that's not often something people do. There tends to be a kind of a slurry in terms of the way people respond to film. And, you know, that the emotional response forgives misinformation. And that's not the way you work at all.
From the beginning, I've tried to look up things and not just, you know, there are so many great Hollywood stories, anecdotes, right? And covering this particular industry, you're dealing with people who, you know, they give great stories. That's what they do. You know, if I were covering the banking industry, I'm not sure they would have, you know, like this level of interest in their anecdotes. But I realized pretty early on that I didn't want to be a purveyor of nonsense. So I started looking things up or whatever. And even so, from time to time, I've been guilty of finding a story so irresistible, I put it up anyway. But at least I try to warn people, like, you know, I'm choosing to believe this is true because it's a great story. but I'm not telling you it's true.
Well, but I mean, even in those cases, you will admit that these pieces are conditional.
yeah.
And I, as I mentioned to you, I wanted to have you on because of a piece you wrote last summer, which I thought was kind of, given that we've just had the Oscars, we're recording this the Monday, the day after the Oscars, your piece, John Wayne and the Six Security Men. And there's just been, in fact, such a onslaught of information about, well, how best to put this, Sasheen Littlefeather, and so much, really kind of enjoying this kind of this tsunami of emotional response to who she was and what she represented, that I thought you were the perfect person to write a piece, because unlike a lot of blogs, there's reporting in this piece and a real sort of dissection of what the facts of the matter were versus the way people were responding, and thanks to the internet are still responding to that incident. Can you talk about what really piqued your interest with that?
What happened was last year at the Academy Awards, there was the slap incident, and it really, I don't think we need to go into it any more than that. But
no.
I was on Twitter I started seeing a whole bunch of tweets saying, you know, well, you know, you think this is bad, you know, John Wayne tried to assault this Native American activist, and variations on that theme, right? You know, it took six men to hold him back, you know, and he was going to charge the stage and drag her off. And it piqued my interest right away. This was like, first of all, I was like, I'm a big John Wayne fan. I've read a lot about him. This is news to me. And, so I immediately started casually Googling, trying to see what the source of this was, because nobody linked to anything. And eventually I started finding links, but then what was curious about those links was that they weren't quoting witnesses. It was never, I saw John Wayne, you know, held back by security guards. No, it was always, you know, just that this happened. I said, well, that's even more interesting. So one nice thing about the internet age is that you are, you know, it's not so hard to dive into something like newspapers.com and look at contemporary coverage. I also use Lantern Media History quite a lot, which has the trades, most of the trades. and fan magazines and the like. And I very rapidly discovered that it was going to be a lot harder to track it down than I thought it was going to be. But the irony from my point of view is that I wasn't really looking to find out much about Sasheen Littlefeather. It became clear to me pretty quickly that she had only started telling this story in interviews, you know, later on. Like, I think the earliest reference I found was like, you know, the 1990s. So I figured that, you know, she had just heard it and sort of believed it. And so I wasn't focusing on her at all. But then when the article came out, it did seem to, whether, you know, by chance or whatever, sort of be the leading edge of a whole bunch of more information about Sasheen.
Well, I guess I'm interested too, because not only those sources, but you also went and dug up one of Wayne's biographers, who I thought did a pretty even-handed job in covering John Wayne in this book.
Yes, Scott Iman. That's a really good book, because he's not really making excuses for John Wayne's worst behavior. And, you know, there's a fair amount of worst in there.
There is.
I guess that's me being tactful.
But he's not an apologist, which is, I mean, the book is actually itself got a lot of straightforward reporting in there and dealing with these kinds of questions of myth and incident versus truth.
Yeah. I mean, my attitude has always been, you know, like, if you want to hate and despise John Wayne, you've got a whole bunch of great, legitimate, easily documented reasons to do so, right? You know, kind of starting with that infamous Playboy interview from, I think, 1971, and then going back a lot further than that. So I wasn't kind of thinking about that so much when I was trying to track down this story. I was accused after it came out of trying to defend John Wayne. You know, they were like, well, you know, she's written about how much she likes him as an actor and his performances. She's trying to you know, whitewash a white supremacist. And I was like, no, that's not it at all. You know, this is not about like how I feel about him one way or another. It's simply about me trying to track down something. I mean, I spent a day and a half on it, and I was already pretty sure I was dealing with some kind of weird urban myth.
By the way, speaking of mythology, it's the treatment my guest is Farron DeMay. Her terrific blog, Self-Styled Siren, again, I think offers a really sharp and unique perspective on the romance of the movies and the powers of the film and the myth versus our own responses to that. I mean, she's a very thoughtful critic and historian on not just film, but popular culture in general. And this piece that we're talking about that ran on her blog, Self-Styled Siren, John Wayne and the Six Security Men, of August of last year, is, I think, a stunning exemplar of her work at its best. Somebody was even telling me recently that I think on his podcast, Bill Maher was talking about this and how everybody's in an uproar and that Jack Lemmon wanted to attack her. And I thought, no, I don't remember any of this kind of stuff when this thing happened. And it's this snowball rolling down the hill. And because I think we live in a time where things are so divisive, there tends to be a look backwards using the same kind of, I'm not sure what the opposite rose-colored glasses are, but certainly looking backwards with this same perspective, isn't there?
I forget who it was who said that every generation wants to think they invented sex, you know, and I feel like our generation also wants to think that it invented morality and ethics and, you know, and broad-mindedness. And, you know, and that is not really the case. So we tend to maybe look back on, you know, the earlier parts of Hollywood and maybe put in an more of an emphasis on the things that they did wrong, not bringing to light, you know, like everything for a full perspective, right? With Sasheen, it was also interesting. The first thing I did was I went in and I started looking up the coverage of, you know, in the immediate aftermath from March 28th, the day after that Academy Awards ceremony, you know, up to like a full year afterward. And, you know, nobody mentions any such incident, right? So if you go and you do the same thing with, I think it was 2 years later, the infamous Hearts and Minds incident.
Just
to fill people in, the producer of Hearts and Minds, a really brilliant but deliberately polemical documentary about Vietnam, read a telegram on air from the North Vietnamese, who I believe at the time were, you know, engaged in negotiations at that very moment. Some of the conservatives backstage were up in arms, including Frank Sinatra and Bob Hope. They got together. They put a statement together. Sinatra read it on stage. So the reason I know this is because it was published 24 or 48 hours later, you know, by gossip columnists like Rex Reed and reporters and things who had people calling them going, you wouldn't believe what went down backstage. I mean, I have not been backstage at the Oscars. It is my understanding that it is not a ghost town. You know, like if you try to charge six security men, it's quite likely somebody's going to notice. So that was another reason why it was suspicious to me. You know, you can say, oh, well, they tried to hush it up. And I was like, oh, so, you know, they hush up something for John Wayne, but not for Frank. I'm not sure I'm buying that.
I think, you know, the Birch Schneider position in Hollywood, too. And I think you're getting to a great point here, which I wanted to bring up, and I'm glad that you did, which is that I think these two events were kind of conflated because people's hearts and minds just kind of disappear from memory. And it was a documentary that wouldn't have nearly the impact of something like Marlon Brando refusing an Oscar, which was not something that happened very often. Also, people were reacting to Brando, too. And I recall, as you mentioned, John Wayne sort of being a little disappointed with the way Brando behaved, and given how much of Wayne is affect, but that's time for your next conversation. It's funny for him to call out somebody else for being disingenuous. But anyway, all those elements combined, I think, are what sort of shaped this look back at the Oscars of that year with Sasheen Little Feather and her making a statement on Brando's behalf. I think people have sort of combined these two things and have done everything but thrown in Will Smith coming out and trying to slap her. And I'm sure in years to come, that will be part of this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it must be said that Little Feather herself, in her later years, you know, like her first interviews were very much focused on her hopes of a Hollywood career. And that never really materialized, right? So as time went on, like in the 80s or the 90s, you know, and I invite anybody to go and double check what I'm saying here. It's easy enough. Her interviews would focus more and more on things that she said about her childhood. And then she would start layering in other things that she said happened to her on that night in 1973, like people doing the tomahawk chop at her, which did not exist in 1973. I know more about that Oscar night than any one person probably should. I didn't come across any reports of that, nor did I come across reports of people making racist, like, war whoops at her or whatever. Nothing like that. But these were the kind of claims that she would, you know, sort of layer in to her interviews as time went on to sort of, you know, build up her part in history. And perhaps also, you know, because she, you know, was concerned about maintaining her bona fides as a Native American, which, of course, you know, like we have now her sisters saying that, you know, they were non-existent, right? She was essentially playing a part that night. This is what they say. This is what some research that's been brought to light also says. But again, I didn't I wasn't thinking about any of this at the time. I was just like, who the hell saw John Wayne, like, you know, struggling with security guards? That was my, you know, prompt.
And you also mentioned something in the piece that, again, and I'm fascinated by this because it is about this sort of romance with these, what movies can do and people buying into image and persona. And you mentioned something I think people tend to have forgot, in fact, they knew, which is he was recently recovered from a pretty arduous medical procedure, hadn't he?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the year, but it was in the 60s, you know, and I think like in the first half of the 60s, you know, he had lung cancer. They took out a couple of ribs. They took out most of one of his lungs. And, you know, you can imagine what that would do to your breathing capacity. He was supposed to quit smoking. He really kind of didn't. And he continued to drink or whatever. So by 1973, all of this was catching up with him, and I think visibly so. I'm currently working on something about The Shootist, which was his last movie, and they shot that one. They shot that one at like high elevations, and it was horrible for him. You know, he'd have to go and lie down, you know, after certain shots and things. You know, and I think in some cases they just wound up having to kind of, you know, work around his physical capabilities. So that was just 3 years later. It really is like kind of an eyebrow raising thing to think that it would have taken six men to hold this guy back. So it, to me, actually, it says the image of John Wayne is still so potent. And really, there are very few actors from that era where you can say that. People who I would swear have never seen a John Wayne movie were tweeting at me after this article came back saying, you know, well, racists are reactionary, you know, and sometimes if people get really, really angry, they get an enormous burst of strength. And that's not what I think happened. And I don't think it works that way when you're an old man with one lung.
No, I would probably, you know, I'm going to put my medical expertise aside for a second, but I'll agree with you on that in the abstract. But I would say this, though, and especially since we just saw the Oscars, that was the period, too, where it was just, there were generational shifts happening in a real way in terms of not only the way movie stars were appearing, but the way that stuff was being covered. And there was a real schism between the way the left was being covered versus the right. And I think all of these moments, because this felt kind of new, and also the emergence of a culture that was a reaction to what John Wayne and those kind of founding fathers and mothers of the business brought to the movie business, I feel like all this stuff is people kind of looking back on things that they don't know a whole lot about and just sort of saying, well, this must have been the way it is because it's the way it felt.
I found myself, you know, going down other rabbit holes while I was doing this research, you know, just about the schism, as you say, that there was like in the early 70s. You know, there was a big segment of like young liberal Hollywood that really didn't like John Wayne, didn't like what he stood for, you know, and was not shy about saying so, you know, in public. Or whatever. There was also a segment of newspaper reporters who, having found out that they could bait the man into saying really revolting, but, you know, eyeball grabbing things, you know, would try to draw him out on these subjects in interviews and things. And because his views were really not, you know, very, in some cases, abhorrent, you know, like running a gamut from like mildly offensive to, you know, absolutely inconceivably wrong. They would, you know, ask him things that were meant to kind of draw these things out. And then on the opposite hand, you have people, you know, trying to do that with, you know, some of the leftiest elements of Hollywood, like Jane Fonda or whatever. And I think like also young Hollywood was, you know, kind of in a, It was a lot more common then just to not go to the Oscars, to think they were uncool. You know, that was like dad's Hollywood, you know, that they were kind of over that. It was bourgeois or whatever. It's, you know, like if you go back and you look at clips from the 1970s Oscars, it's always kind of startling to see how many people just didn't show up. you know, they didn't send somebody to turn down the Oscar the way Brando did, but, you know, they didn't bother.
Yeah, we're out of time. I would only say thank you. You've got to come do the show again. My guest is Farron DeMay. Of course, if you don't, you should know her terrific blog, Self Style Siren. I would suggest you go out and find her book, Missing Reels, which is another terrific piece of writing. And I can't thank you enough for doing this on such late notice. And please come do the show again.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Farron DeMay, cultural commentator, critic, and historian. You'll find her as Self-Styled Siren on Substack. It's worth the search. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treat. Daniels, Kwan, and Scheinert recently, very recently, won Oscars for writing, producing, and directing. They're offering a pair of treats about feeling, thought, and taking action.
Hi, this is Daniel Kwan, and this is The Treat. Today, I just want to talk about a book I just finished last week that I've been thinking a lot about. It's a graphic novel by Sophia Warren called Radical, My Year with a Socialist Editor. I just really was taken by this book because I think beyond the story of following around Julia Salazar, the New York State Senator, around for a year, that's like the main story. The story underneath it all is Sophia, the cartoonist, just being a regular human being who suddenly felt very concerned with the world and with politics and wanted to find a way into it, but didn't know how. And so she just kind of did what she knew, which was draw. But she decided to take that energy and take that talent and dive headfirst into following around Julia Salazar and her team as they figured out how to do state-level politics. So it's incredibly educational, but also I think it's a beautiful blueprint for anyone out there who's feeling lost, like they don't have anything to offer the political climate. I'm a firm believer everyone has something to offer, and finding that intersection is going to be very fulfilling. So yeah, I really love the book, and I learned so much. It's great.
I'm Daniel Scheinert. I work with Daniel Kwan. I'll piggyback off his favorite book and talk about my favorite city councilwoman. Her name is Eunices Hernandez. She just got elected. Since this is the Los Angeles show, and I listen to KCRW all the time, if you read Radical and you get inspired, there's a lady you can go support that fits in with those values a lot. And I've just been so moved to watch her fight the good fight and start making a difference. I'm really hoping that Kevin DeLeon hurries up and just resigns so that our city council can head in a new direction.
And there's the treat.
free from destiny. Not only what we sow, not only what we show.
Oscar winners Daniels, Kwan, and Scheinert. They won for Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, and now authors of The Treat. Other filmmakers have provided The Treat, including Paul Feig. Hear previous editions at kcow.com/thetreat, and award winners and nominees. Hear their interviews at kcow.com/FYC. Award winners from creative fields of every endeavor, ranging from film to books, style to sports, offering stories on the narratives that change their lives. That's The Treat. Rebecca Mooney produces and edits the show, which is mixed by Katie Gilchrist. Help, we got it from Anna Buss and Laura Gondarajan. To better days, everyone, I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.